Well, thanks for coming. The handout is not directly relevant to this session, so you don't need to worry if you don't have one. Rather, the handout that's going around is, first of all, an outline of the field of apologetics to give you a sort of bird's eye view of what we do in Christian apologetics. And it shows the various components that go to make up Christian apologetics. On the one hand, offensive or positive apologetics, which attempt to give reasons for the justification of Christian truth claims, and then on the other hand, defensive or negative apologetics, which attempts to answer objections to the truth of Christian truth claims. And you'll see on the handout when you get at the various subdivisions of these fields of Christian apologetics. And then there's also a bibliography that's going around that contains recommended resources for the study of Christian apologetics that you might want to pursue in the future. Let me just mention that if you're interested in arguments for God's existence, such as the one we're going to be talking about today, the current issue of Christianity Today, God Is Not Dead Yet, has a cover story on the renaissance of arguments for the existence of God in Anglo-American philosophy today. The editors at CT invited me to write an article on this subject, and they liked it enough that they made it the cover story. And this describes not only the renaissance that's happening among Anglo-American philosophers with regard to arguments for God's existence, but also it details what some of those arguments are. And we'll be discussing one of these, the moral argument, in our session today. If you're interested in having more detail about the argument, I'll commend to you my book, Reasonable Faith. This is the third revised and updated edition that just came out this past week. So this is fresh off the presses and contains a detailed defense of the moral argument for God's existence. In our very brief time together today, I'll only have a chance to hit the high points of this argument, but if your interest is piqued, you can pursue it further in the book Reasonable Faith. Let me begin by asking you a question for your consideration. Can we be good without God? Can we be good without God? Now, at first, the answer to this question might seem so obvious that even to ask it is apt to arouse indignation. For of course, atheists and agnostics can lead what we would normally characterize as good and decent lives, even though they don't believe in God. Indeed, sometimes their lives often put ours as believers to shame, by contrast. So it seems the answer to this question is obvious. Of course you can lead a good life, you can be good, without belief in God. But wait a minute, the question was not, can we be good without belief in God? The question was, can we be good without God? And when we ask that question, we're asking a very profound question about the nature of moral values. Are the moral values that we hold dear and guide our lives by mere social conventions akin to driving on the right-hand versus the left-hand side of the road? Or are they just expressions of personal taste, like having a taste for certain foods or not? Or are moral values somehow valid and binding independent of our perception of them? And if they are objective in this way, then what is their foundation? Well, many philosophers have thought that the existence of objective moral values provides a good argument for the existence of God. I myself stumbled into this argument accidentally through the back door, so to speak. I was speaking on university campuses on the absurdity of life without God. And I would argue that apart from God's existence, there are no objective moral values and duties. Everything becomes relative. And to my surprise, the reaction of the students was to insist that some things really are right and wrong, that objective values really do exist. Now, what the students were saying didn't in any way refute the argument that I was giving, that without God there were no objective moral values. Instead, what they had done was unwittingly supply the missing premise in a moral argument for God's existence. For now we can argue, premise one, if God does not exist, Objective moral values do not exist. If God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. But premise two, objective moral values do exist, from which it follows logically that three, therefore, God exists. Premise one was the argument that I was offering, that if there is no God, then there are no objective moral values. Premise two was what the students were insisting on. But together, they imply three, therefore, God exists. Now, this simple little argument is easy to memorize, and it's logically ironclad. If the two premises are true, then the conclusion follows necessarily and inescapably. And together, they imply the existence of God. Now, what makes this argument so powerful, I think, is that people generally believe both of the premises. In our pluralistic age, I find that students are absolutely terrified of imposing their moral views or beliefs on anybody else. So premise one seems correct to them, that if there is no God, then objective moral values do not exist. But premise two also seems true to them. Certain values have been deeply instilled into students, such as tolerance and open-mindedness. They think that it's objectively wrong to impose your moral values on somebody else. So they're deeply committed to premise two as well. And this can lead to some very strange conversations. I remember talking with one unbelieving student once in which we would discuss the first premise and he would then deny the second. Then I would move to the second premise and he would affirm it and deny the first. And so back and forth we would go, jumping back and forth between the two premises, with him not knowing which one to affirm and which one to deny. It would have been funny if it hadn't been so pathetic to see someone floundering desperately to elude the conclusion that God exists based upon plausible beliefs that he in fact held to. So what I'd like to do is to examine in a little bit more detail each of the premises and see what defense can be offered on their behalf and what objections the non-believer might raise to them. Well, now, before we look at the first premise in more detail in terms of its defense, I think it would be helpful if we clarify a couple of important distinctions. Well, at least one important distinction for this morning's purposes. And that is the distinction between something being objective and subjective. I find that students often do not understand this. By objective, I mean independent of people's opinions. Okay, there it is. That's the definition. Write it down. Independent of people's opinions. That's what it means to be objective. So, to say that there are objective moral values is to say that something is good or bad independently of what people think about it. Similarly, to say that we have objective moral duties is to say that we have certain obligations, even if nobody believes that we have those obligations. So, for example, to say that the Holocaust was objectively wrong is to say that the Holocaust was wrong even though the Nazis who carried it out thought that it was right. And it would still have been wrong even if the Nazis had won World War II and succeeded in brainwashing or exterminating everybody who disagreed with them so that it was universally believed that the Holocaust was right. And the point is that if God does not exist, then moral values are not objective in that way. So consider the problem of moral values. Traditionally, moral values have been based in God, who is conceived to be the highest good. But if God does not exist, then what foundation can be given for objective moral values? In particular, why think that human beings have moral worth? The most popular form of atheism, as J.P. Moreland explained last night, is naturalism. Naturalism holds that the only things that exist are those things which are provided by our best scientific theories. But of course, science is morally neutral. You can't find moral values in a test tube. So it immediately follows on naturalism that moral values don't really exist. They're just illusions of human beings. So given the most popular view of atheism, it follows immediately that there are no objective moral values. But even if the atheist is willing to go beyond the bounds of science, why think that on atheism human beings are objectively morally valuable? After all, on atheism, human beings are just accidental byproducts of nature, which have evolved relatively recently on an infinitesimal speck of dust called the planet Earth, lost somewhere in a mindless and indifferent universe, and which are doomed to perish individually and collectively in a relatively short time. Richard Dawkins' assessment of human value may be depressing, but why, on atheism, is he mistaken when he says, and I quote, "There is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for being." On a naturalistic view, moral values are just the byproduct of biological evolution and social conditioning. Just as a troop of baboons will exhibit altruistic behavior because natural selection has determined it to be advantageous in the struggle for survival, so their primate cousins, Homo sapiens, have similarly evolved certain patterns of behavior for the same reason. As a result of sociobiological pressures, there's evolved among Homo sapiens a sort of herd morality, which is useful in the propagation of our species in the struggle for survival. But there doesn't seem to be anything about Homo sapiens that makes this morality objectively true. To think that human beings are special or morally valuable is to be guilty of speciesism, an unjustified bias in favor of one's own species. So, if there is no God, then any basis for regarding the herd morality evolved by Homo sapiens on this planet seems to have been, regarding it as objectively true, seems to have been removed. If you take God out of the picture, then all you're left with is an advanced primate creature on this planet in a speck of space with delusions of moral grandeur. Or consider moral duties. Moral duties were typically thought to be grounded in God's commandments, such as the Ten Commandments. But if there isn't any God to issue commandments to us, why think that we have any moral duties? On the atheistic view, human beings don't seem to have any moral obligations to one another. For example, in the animal kingdom, if a lion kills a zebra, it kills the zebra, but it doesn't murder the zebra. If a great white shark copulates forcibly with a female, it forcibly copulates with the female, but it doesn't rape the female. For there is no moral dimension to these actions. None of these things is prohibited or commanded. They are neither forbidden nor obligatory. So if God doesn't exist, why think that we have any moral obligations? Who or what imposes such prohibitions or obligations upon us? Where did they come from? It's hard to see why moral duties would be anything more than the illusory byproducts of social and parental conditioning. So, admittedly, certain actions like incest and rape have become taboo in the course of human evolution. But on atheism, that does absolutely nothing to show that such actions are really wrong. Activity that looks like rape and incest goes on all the time in the animal kingdom. So the rapist who chooses to flout the herd morality is really on atheism doing nothing more than acting unfashionably. He's like the man who violates social conventions by belching loudly at the dinner table. If there isn't any moral lawgiver, then there isn't any moral law that imposes itself upon us. Now, it's extremely important that we remain clear about this argument, this premise before us, I can almost guarantee to you that if you present this argument to an unbeliever, they will react with indignation by saying, how dare you say that atheists are immoral and indecent people, that we cannot live good and decent lives. And we need to help them understand that this is a complete misunderstanding of the argument. The question is not, must we believe in God in order to live moral lives? There's no reason to think that in order to live what we normally characterize as a good and decent life, that you have to believe in God. Again, the question is not, can we recognize objective moral values without believing in God? I certainly think that you can. You don't need to believe in God to recognize that we ought to love our children rather than torture them. Rather, the question is, if God does not exist, do objective moral values exist? The question is not about the necessity of belief in God for morality. It's about the necessity of the existence of God for morality. And I've been shocked, quite honestly, at how frequently professional philosophers misunderstand this argument. People who should know better and not confuse this. For example, I had a debate several years ago at Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania with Paul Kurtz, the famous humanist philosopher, on the topic, goodness without God is good enough. And I argued that if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. And Kurtz, to my astonishment, completely missed the point. This is how he responded, and I quote, "If God is essential, then how is it possible for the millions and millions of people who don't believe in God to nonetheless behave morally and ethically? On your view, they could not. And so God is just not essential. Many people, indeed millions of people, have been optimistic about life, have lived a full life and find life exciting and significant. Yet they don't wring their hands about whether or not there is an afterlife. It's living here and now that counts." Now, Kurtz's point only shows that belief in God is not necessary for living a moral life and an optimistic life. It does absolutely nothing to refute the first premise that if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Now, the other response that you can count on getting to this argument is the so-called Euthyphro dilemma, named after a character in one of Plato's dialogues. And this dilemma basically goes like this. Is something good because God wills it, or does God will it because it's good? If you say that something is good because God wills it, then that makes moral values arbitrary. God could have willed that we should be hateful and cruel to one another, and then we would be obligated to hate each other. And that seems crazy. Some moral values at least seem to be necessary. But if you say, on the other hand, that God wills something because it is good, then you've made the good independent of God. And in that case, moral values do not depend upon God, as premise one claims. Well, in fact, the Euthyphro dilemma is a false dilemma. That is to say, it presents us with a false choice. There's a third alternative, namely, God wills something because he is good. God wills something because he is good. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that God's own nature is the standard of goodness, and his commandments to us are expressions of his own nature, so that our moral duties are determined by the commandments of a just and loving God. So moral values are not independent of God because God's own character determines what is objectively right and wrong. Moral values are rooted in the character of God. God is essentially compassionate, fair, impartial, just, and so forth. So his moral nature defines good and evil. Moreover, his moral commandments to us necessarily reflect his character. They are necessary expressions of his being, and therefore they are not arbitrary. So if the atheist says to you, if God were to command child abuse, would we be morally obligated to abuse our children? The answer is to say that this is an incoherent question. It's like asking, if there were a square circle, Would its area be the square of one of its sides? It's a meaningless question because the conditional premise is incoherent. It's logically impossible. So the Euthyphro dilemma is a false dilemma, and we shouldn't be tricked by it. The morally good or bad is determined by God's nature, and the morally right and wrong, our duties, are determined by God's commandments, which is rooted in his nature. Now, I'm going to skip ahead to jump to premise two, that objective moral values and duties do exist. I initially thought that this would be the most controversial premise of the argument, and this is would be what people attack. But I have been shocked that in my debates with atheistic philosophers, this premise is almost never denied. It may surprise you to learn, in fact, that surveys taken on university campuses show that professors are less relativistic than the students are, and that of the faculty, the philosophy professors are the ones most apt to believe in objective moral values and are the least relativistic of the faculty. So that the more you know about ethics and morality, the more apt you are to be an absolutist or an objectivist or moral realist. So philosophers who reflect upon our moral experience see no more reason to distrust that experience than to distrust the evidence of our five senses. Just as my five senses indicate to me that there is an objective world of physical objects out there, so in my moral experience, I grasp a realm of objective moral values. And in the absence of some defeater of my moral experience, I have no more reason to deny the objectivity of the realm of moral values than I have to deny the objectivity of the physical world. And I find that most people do believe in objective moral values. If you just talk with them a little while. Most people think that, for example, sexual abuse of children is wrong, or actions like rape, torture, and child abuse are morally wrong. Similarly, they think certain things are really good, like tolerance, open-mindedness, love, generosity, and self-sacrifice. And people who fail to see this are just morally handicapped. And there's no reason to allow their impairment to call into question what we see clearly. So I found that although people give lip service to relativism, 95% of people can be very quickly convinced of premise two if you just share some examples with them. Ask what they think, for example, about the Crusades or the Inquisition or Catholic priests abusing little boys sexually and then trying to cover it up. Use religious examples of atrocities committed in the name of religion or by the church, and I think you'll find very quickly that people do come to agree with premise two. But then it follows from those two premises that God exists. Now, much, much more could be said in defense of these, but I want to allow time for questions, so I'm going to quit now and throw it open to your questions, referring you to the discussion of the moral argument in reasonable faith if you want to learn more. Yes. The problem with these attempts, I think, is that they become arbitrary and implausible. For example, on the atheistic view, rationality is simply the byproduct of having a more complex nervous system. And why think that having a greater complexity in your nervous system somehow makes you morally valuable? That just doesn't seem to make sense. Where does moral value come from having a complex nervous system? Moreover, as one of my atheistic philosopher friends pointed out, who has a mentally retarded child, it would follow on this view that his boy has no moral value because he's not rational. And that is very sobering to say to someone that their child is morally valueless and therefore anything could be done to him, really, when you think about it. So I find all such attempts, which I think need to be treated on a case-by-case basis, to be ultimately implausible and arbitrary. Yes, the definition of God that is used here would be the classical definition that Anselm gave. God is the greatest conceivable being. And so the greatest conceivable being would be a God which is morally perfect and therefore good. So you're quite right that this is assuming the classical concept of God. Obviously, if God is something like Vishnu or Molech or something, then this wouldn't apply to him. This is talking about the concept of God as the greatest conceivable being. Right. Well, what I would say, and this is where I like their work, I would say, if there is no God, then you're absolutely correct. But the question is there a God? If there is a God, then the fact that moral values have developed and evolved through an evolutionary process says nothing about their objectivity. To think so would be to commit the genetic fallacy, that is to say, trying to invalidate a position by showing how it came to be held. At best, their views would only show that our apprehension of the realm of objective moral values is the product of evolution and social conditioning. But that gradual, fallible apprehension of the moral realm no more undermines the objectivity of that realm than our fallible, gradual apprehension of the physical world undermines the objectivity of the physical world. If God exists, then there is a realm of objective moral values independent of us, regardless of what evolutionary story you want to tell about how we came to know those moral values. So it seems to me that they're quite right that if atheism is true, then they're correct. But the question is, well, is atheism is true? Is it true? And they can't just presuppose that without begging the question. If you presuppose that, you're begging the question. If you don't presuppose that, well, then there can well be a God, and God could have designed our faculties in such a way that we would come to apprehend the moral values that are represented by his nature. So the argument, I think, is ultimately question-begging in favor of naturalism. That would be a real problem if that's what they believed, that somehow human flourishing is a good or survivability. I think the people Richard's talking about are more radical than that, and they wouldn't say that human flourishing or survivability is good any more than that guinea pigs survive or is good. I mean, these folks are really radical nihilists, I take it, or at least they espouse it. But I would, again, look for inconsistencies. For example, Dawkins would be one such person who says there is no good, there is no evil, nothing but pointless indifference. But he is an undying moralist. His book is filled with moral judgments condemning homophobia, religious indoctrination of children, the Amish. He even gives a list of his own 10 commandments that should replace the traditional ones. So it's very difficult, frankly, to live consistently with this viewpoint. Michael Ruse, whom I often quote, is a philosopher of science that's an agnostic and one of these evolutionary ethicists who believes that ethics is just illusory, has no objectivity. But nevertheless, when pressed, Ruse says in print that the man who says that it is morally permissible to rape little children is just as mistaken as the man who says 2 plus 2 equals 5. Now, when you think 2 plus 2 equals 4 is a necessary truth, he's saying that some of these moral truths are necessary truths, and therefore objective truths that are not dependent upon human opinion. And that's completely consistent with his espousal of evolutionary theory and moral anti-realism. So I do think we should look for these inconsistencies and just say to them, given all that you believe about evolutionary theory and so forth, do you nevertheless really think, I mean, do you really believe that it is morally permissible to rape little children? And most people will say, no, after considering it all, I guess I don't think that's really right. Yes, in the blue shirt.
Right, if we're indifferent, isn't he being indifferent about indifference?
Yeah. I think that what he would say when he says it's indifferent, I think he means that nature, that reality and nature is indifferent to our survival and success and so forth. But he doesn't mean that human beings are indifferent about things. But he should say, if he's consistent, that these petty projects and concerns that we fill our lives with are ultimately of no significance and illusory in the grand scheme of things. Well, I would say that this argument at least gives us a necessarily existing, personal locus of absolute moral goodness. Now, that's not unknowability. That's huge. If you've got a necessarily existing, personal source and standard of absolute moral goodness. That gives us a lot. Now, it doesn't tell you that he's the creator. For that, you'll need to turn to the argument I discussed last hour. And it doesn't tell you that he's, say, omnipresent. It doesn't give you all the attributes of God. But it's a far cry from unknowability. As I said in the last hour, this is not some ill-defined flying spaghetti monster. This is a being that has specific attributes, namely a personal mind, which is the locus of absolute goodness and exists necessarily. That's pretty significant, I'd say. Yes? Well, that's true, and we can admit that, but only in the sense that, for example, human beings are not chairs. We have a different nature than a chair, and a chair doesn't have the sort of intrinsic moral value that human beings do. So that's certainly true, but then the question is, why is it that a being endowed with this particular nature that we call a human nature, why is that thing valuable? And there it seems to me you've got to go beyond that nature to some sort of a transcendent grounding that will allow you to say this is objectively good. Otherwise, I don't see any reason on atheism to think that that nature that is exemplified by these living creatures on this planet is objectively valuable. Yes, here. Yes. I think that's true, though I don't think adding those additional elements adds anything essential to the illustration. The illustration just makes the point that when we say something is objective, it means that even if there were universal dissent against it, it would still be the case. That's all it means. I'm just giving a definition of what it is to be objective, or an illustration of what it is to be objective.
I think more emotional.
Well, perhaps. Let's see, anyone who hasn't asked a question yet. Yes. Well, there are certainly ethicists like Peter Singer who think that whales and porpoises and great apes have moral value, and even greater moral value than, say, human infants. So the questions might look a little bit different, but I don't think that would affect my argument. He does think that these whales and porpoises and great apes have objective moral value. As I understand him, he is not a relativist by any means. He is a moral realist who thinks it is really morally wrong to, say, kill porpoises in trying to drag nets to catch tuna. And therefore, he would agree with premise two that objective moral values exist. But my question for him would be even more pressing on number one, why think that things like porpoises and chimpanzees and human beings have objective moral value on atheism? These are just natural spin-offs of evolution, and it seems arbitrary to think that these strange moral properties like goodness and badness impinge on these creatures. Well, we're out of time. Let me just say in conclusion that I have found, to my chagrin actually, because I like the cosmological argument the best, that this argument is the most effective argument I've ever found in dealing with students on university campuses. Because whereas other arguments for the existence of God can be dismissed as intellectual curiosities, this one really hits you where you live. Every day you get up, you answer whether or not you think objective moral values exist by how you live and treat other people. And therefore, this argument has tremendous existential force that cannot be escaped. So I would encourage you to memorize the two premises, share them with unbelievers, and have open discussions of this sort with them. And I think you'll find it a great springboard to talking about your faith.